He crawls into his little bed and cries himself to sleep. After that, I usually feel sorry for him, and I let him win a game or two. Rookie. I liked them all very much, but we had hard times. I was a serious recluse before I moved in with the guys at Graceland. When you live on your own for years, you begin to think the world belongs to you. You begin to think all space is your space and all time is your time. It's like in that movie About a Boy where Nick Hornby's chief character, played by Hugh Grant, believes that life is a play about himself, that all other characters are only acting minor roles in a story that centers around him. My life felt like that. Life was a story about me because I was in every scene. In fact, I was the only one in every scene. I was everywhere I went. If somebody walked into my scene, it would frustrate me because they were disrupting the general theme of the play, namely, my comfort or glory. Other people were flat characters in my movie, lifeless characters. Sometimes I would have scenes with them, dialogue, and they would speak their lines and I would speak mine. But the movie, the grand movie stretching from Adam to the Antichrist, was about me. I wouldn't have told you that at the time, but that is the way I lived. Tuck was one of my best friends when he moved in. He is still one of my best friends, but for a while I wanted to kill him. He did not understand that life was a movie about me. Nobody ever told him. He would knock on my door while I was reading, come in and sit down in a chair opposite me, and then he would want to talk. He would want to hear about my day. I couldn't believe it. The audacity to come into my room, my sound stage, and interrupt the obvious flow of the story with questions about how I am. I would give Tuck little signals that I didn't want to talk, like eye rolls or short answers to his questions. I would stare into space so he thought I was crazy, or snore so he would think I had fallen asleep. I think I hurt his feelings. He would get very frustrated with me, go upstairs, and wonder why I was acting that way. He only did this a few times before he dismissed me as a jerk. I almost lost the friendship, to be honest. I didn't like the feeling of having to work with people. We would have a community meeting and talk about who wasn't doing their chores or who was leaving dirty dishes in the sink, and if I felt accused, I would lash back at whoever accused me. I was confident I was right and they were wrong. I could not see at the time that I was being rude. There were a few times when Trevor actually stood up and walked out of the room. It was always because of me. The other guys had lived with people before. They knew all about people. Living in community made me realize one of my faults. I was addicted to myself. All I thought about was myself. The only thing I really cared about was myself. I had very little concept of love, altruism, or sacrifice. I discovered that my mind is like a radio that picks up only one station, the one that plays me. K-Don, all Don, all the time. I did not understand the exchange that takes place in meaningful dialogue when two people sit down and tune their radios, if only for a moment, to the other person's station. It must have been painful for Tuck to try so desperately to catch my station, and for me to brush him off. Having had my way for so long, I became defensive about what I perceived as encroachments on my rights. My personal bubble was huge. I couldn't have conversations that lasted more than 10 minutes. I wanted efficiency in personal interaction, and while listening to one of my housemates talk, I wondered why they couldn't get to the point. "What are you trying to tell me?" I would think. "Do we really have to stand here and make small talk?" Tuck told me later that in the first few months of living with me, he felt judged, as though there was something wrong with him. He felt unvalued any time he was around me. The most difficult lie I have ever contended with is this. Life is a story about me. God brought me to Graceland to rid me of this deception, to scrub it out of the gray matter of my mind. It was a frustrating and painful experience. I hear addicts talk about the shakes and panic attacks and the highs and lows of resisting their habit, and to some degree I understand them because I have had habits of my own. But no drug is so powerful as the drug of self. No rut in the mind is so deep as the one that says, I am the world. The world belongs to me. All people are characters in my play. There is no addiction so powerful as self-addiction. In the spring of my year at Graceland, when the ground was beginning to dry at Laurelhurst Park, a friend and I traveled to Salem to hear Brennan Manning speak. Manning is a former Catholic priest and a wonderful writer who has struggled with alcoholism and speaks frankly about matters of Christian spirituality. We sat so close I could see the blue in Brennan's eyes and that quality of sincerity you find in people who have turned trial into service. Brennan grew up in New York and speaks with a slight East Coast bite that has been sanded down by years of smoking. An ear has to work a bit to keep his pace. He opened his talk with the story of Zacchaeus. Brennan talked about how an entire town, with their ridicule and hatred, could not keep the little man from oppressing them through the extravagant financial gains he made as a tax collector. Christ walked through town, Brennan said, and spotted the man. Christ told Zacchaeus that he would like to have a meal with him. In the single conversation Christ had with Zacchaeus, Brennan reminded us, Jesus spoke affirmation and love, and the tax collector sold his possessions and made amends to those he had robbed. It was the affection of Christ, not the brutality of a town, that healed Zacchaeus. Manning went on to speak of the great danger of a harsh word, the power of unlove to deteriorate a person's heart and spirit, and how, as representatives of the grace and love of God, our communication should be seasoned with love and compassion. While Manning was speaking, I was being shown myself, and I felt like God was asking me to change. I was being asked to walk away from the lies I believed about the world being about me. I had been communicating unlove to my housemates because I thought they were not cooperating with the meaning of life, that meaning being my desire and will and choice and comfort. There was nothing fun about going home that night. I went with new eyes, seeing my housemates as people. For the first time I saw them as people, and I could sense God's love for them. I had been living with God's prized possessions, his children, the dear ones to him, and had considered them a bother to this earth that was mine, this space and time that were mine. In the short year at Graceland, I hurt all the guys at one time or another. Fixing the carnage would take time. I had to make things right with each of them. I had really messed things up. Jeremy, the guy with the Marine haircut who was going to become a cop, couldn't stand me. I had run my car through the garage door one night and neglected to fix it. Jeremy parked his motorcycle in the garage, and so he had to use the broken door every day. My room was directly above the garage, so when Jeremy went to work in the morning at 5 o'clock, he would start his motorcycle engine, and it sounded like somebody was starting a lawnmower next to my bed. I would get furious, and later that night I would ask him if there was something we could do. He said no, that was where he needed to keep his motorcycle. And that was true. So every time Jeremy had trouble getting the broken door up and down, he would get mad at me, and every time he started his motorcycle at 5 a.m., I would get mad at him. The issue, of course, was not about the motorcycle or the door. The issue was about whether or not we respected each other, whether or not we liked each other. One evening, I was down in the basement talking to Tuck while he was working out. I decided to do some laundry while I was down there, but somebody's clothes were in the dryer. There was no place to put them, so I put them on the floor. I didn't think anything of it, you know, because the floor was pretty clean. But it turned out the clothes were Jeremy's, and later that night, when he got home, he wrote a note on our whiteboard to the person who had thrown his clothes on the floor. I didn't actually throw them on the floor, I just sort of set them there, but still, he was pretty heated. I told him it was me, and I apologized. He had to go for a walk, he was so mad. It was the last straw for him. When he came back, I asked him if we could talk. I told him it was time we dealt with it. He kept wanting to walk away from the conversation because he was so mad, but I wouldn't let him. I was ready to apologize. I told him I didn't feel like he cared about me because he started his motorcycle every morning, and I had become defensive about that, and that made me want to get him back, and I had done that sort of subconsciously, with little comments and that sort of thing. I had never told him at the very beginning that I felt like he didn't like me and I wanted him to. Instead, I had been proud and passive-aggressive. That was why we were experiencing all of this. And I told him that I felt bad. I didn't accuse him of anything, which, looking back, was very, very important. And also, I didn't expect anything from him in return. I really didn't feel like he owed me anything. Jeremy listened very carefully once he had calmed down. He was great. He told me how much he liked me, and that meant the world to me. In that moment, I could feel all the anger I had been feeling melt away. I couldn't even remember what I was angry about. And the next morning, when Jeremy started his motorcycle, it didn't even wake me up. I was in San Francisco recently, staying at this bed and breakfast place for people who were in the city to do ministry. It was a small house, but there were probably 15 people living there at the time. The guy who ran the place, Bill, was always making meals or cleaning up after us, and I took note of his incredible patience and kindness. I noticed that not all of us did our dishes after a meal, and very few people thanked him for cooking. One morning, before anybody woke up, Bill and I were drinking coffee at the dining room table. I told him I lived with 5 guys and that it was very difficult for me because I liked my space and needed my privacy. I asked him how he kept such a good attitude all of the time with so many people abusing his kindness. Bill set down his coffee and looked me in the eye. "Don," he said, "if we are not willing to wake up in the morning and die to ourselves, perhaps we should ask ourselves whether or not we are really following Jesus." Chapter 16. Money. Thoughts on paying rent. Writers don't make any money at all. We make about $1. It's terrible. But then again, we don't work either. We sit around in our underwear until noon, then go downstairs and make coffee, fry some eggs, read the paper, read part of a book, smell the book, wonder if perhaps we ourselves should work on our book, smell the book again, throw the book across the room because we are quite jealous that any other person wrote a book, feel terribly guilty about throwing the schmuck's book across the room because we secretly wonder if God in heaven noticed our evil jealousy, or worse, our laziness. We then lie across the couch face down and mumble to God to forgive us because we are secretly afraid he is going to dry up all our words because we envied another man's stupid words. And for this, as I said before, we are paid $1. We are worth so much more. I hate not having money. I hate not being able to go to a movie or out for coffee. I hate that feeling at the ATM when, after getting cash, the little receipt spits out, the one with the number on it, the telling number, the ever-low number that translates into how many days I have left to feel comfortable. The ATM, to me, often feels like a slot machine. I walk up to it, hoping to get lucky. I feel like a complete loser when I don't have money. That's the real problem. I feel invalidated, as if the gods have not approved my existence, as if my allowance has been cut off. We are worth our earning potential, you know. We are worth the money we make. Maybe this is a man thing. Maybe women don't think about this, I don't know, but I think about it. I think I am worth what I earn, which makes me worth $1. Not having money affects the way a man thinks about himself. Last year, I didn't have any money at all. 5 of 12 months last year, I prayed God would send me rent. 5 of 12 months, I received a check in the mail the day rent was due. I was grateful at first, but after a while, to be honest with you, I began to feel like God's charity. At the end of each month, I would start biting my nails, wondering what account owed me money or whether or not I would pick up any writing assignments. There's not a lot of work in the Christian market if you won't write self-righteous conservative propaganda. I write New Realism essays. I am not a commodity. I wondered whether or not I was lazy. When you are a writer, you feel lazy even when you're working. Who gets paid to sit around in a coffee shop all day and type into a computer? But I did work, I kept telling myself. I showed up at Palio every day, and in the evenings I would go to Common Ground. I worked. I wrote. I drove myself crazy writing. The thing is, at the time, I was writing without a contract. So I wasn't really writing for money, I was writing in hopes of money. And when you are writing without a contract, you feel as though everything you say is completely worthless. Technically, it is, until you get a contract. You can write all day and still not feel that you have done anything. A man needs to do some work, needs to get his hands dirty and calloused, and needs to hammer his thumb every once in a while. He needs to get tired at the end of the day, and not just mind tired, body tired too. I wasn't feeling body tired, I was just feeling mind tired, and I didn't have any money, so I wasn't feeling like a man. I was in a bad place. I talked to Rick about it. He came over to the house, and we were sitting around, and I asked him if he thought God really called me to be a writer, or if I was just being lazy, being selfish, tinkering with words. He asked me if I worked. He said that everybody needs to work. I told him I did, but wasn't getting paid for it because I didn't have a contract yet, and getting a contract was no sure thing. At best, I was gambling. He said he didn't know whether what I was doing was right or wrong. He said he would pray for me. I rolled my eyes. He told me I had a gift and he liked me, and God would make things clear if I was being a lazy slob. Imago, our church, is made up of mostly artists and fruit nuts, and none of us have any money, so Rick said if I was going to be a writer, I needed to write a bestseller so that the church could have some money. I am irresponsible with money, if you want to know the truth. I don't have the money to buy big things, thank God, so I buy small things. I like new things too much. I like the way they smell. Today I tried to go to Home Depot to get an extension cord. I need an extension cord to plug in a lamp in the upstairs den. I already bought a timer plug for the lamp, a plug that turns the lamp on in the evening and off after everybody has gone to bed, but now I need an extension cord. We probably didn't need the timer plug in the first place. I could probably have plugged the lamp into the regular socket and been fine. But when I saw the timer plug at Fred Meyer last week, I stood there looking at it, having come across it by accident, and I realized how very much I needed it. And it was only $7. I need this for $7, I thought to myself. This is very important. I put it into my basket and walked off, wondering what it was that I needed to plug into it. That, of course, is now obvious. The lamp in the upstairs den. I got the timer plug home and programmed it without reading the instructions. Then I went to plug the lamp in, but the lamp was too far from the outlet. I could not move the lamp closer without ruining the feng shui. I have this fruit nut friend who says feng shui is very important, that a room should be balanced so that you feel balanced when you were in it. I put the lamp closer to the outlet, and my fruit nut friend was right because I felt very unbalanced. So I would need an extension cord to go with the timer plug. I only say all this to show you that I have a problem with buying things I really don't need. I saw this documentary about the brain that says habits are formed when the pleasure center of the brain lights up as we do a certain behavior. The documentary said that some people's pleasure centers light up when they buy things. I wondered if my pleasure center did that. Penny thinks I am terrible with the little money I have. I was talking to her the other night, and I mentioned that I was interested in buying a remote control car, and she just sort of sat there and didn't say anything. "Penny, are you there?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "What?" I asked. "Are you serious, Don? Are you going to waste perfectly good money on a remote control car?"
"Well, I said.
Miller, that would be a pretty dumb thing to do when there are children starving in India," she told me. I hate it when Penny does this. Honestly, it can be so annoying. She lives it, though. She didn't buy clothes for an entire year, her senior year at Reed, because she felt like she was irresponsible with money. She always looked very beautiful anyway, and for her birthday I bought her some mittens at Saturday Market for $7. She wore them like they were from Tiffany's or something. She always talked about them. They weren't that big of a deal, but she hadn't had any new clothes for a year, so I think she wore them while she was sleeping or something. Penny is right about spending money, though. Penny is right about everything. Penny said if I were to save about $20 a month and give it to Northwest Medical Teams or Amnesty International, I would literally be saving lives. Literally. But that stupid pleasure center goes off in my brain, and it feels like there is nothing I can do about it. I told Penny about the pleasure center and how I needed the remote control car to make the pleasure center light up, and she just took the phone away from her ear and beat it against her chair. The thing about the extension cord is I was pretty sure I had one in the basement, in a box with some other cords, but if I looked, I might have found it, and then I would not have been able to go to Home Depot. What we needed was a new extension cord. The latest technology, I thought to myself. I put my boots on very quickly. The good voice, the frugal voice, the Penny voice started inside my head. "Don, please, there are children who could use this money for Christmas presents." "It's August," I said out loud. "What about environmental movements?" good voice said. "What about the rainforests that could hold a cure for cancer, a cure for AIDS?" "Tree hugger," I said to good voice while putting on my motorcycle helmet. "You have a problem," good voice said. "You're a pansy," I said back. "You're irresponsible," good voice shouted. "Shut your gaping pie hole," I yelled back. The thing about new things is you feel new when you buy them. You feel as though you were somebody different because you own something different. We are our possessions, you know. There are people who get addicted to buying new stuff. Things. Piles and piles of things. But the new things become old things so quickly. We need new things to replace the old things. I like things with buttons. A writer I like named Ravi Zacharias says that the heart desires wonder and magic. He says technology is what man uses to supplant the desire for wonder. Ravi Zacharias says that what the heart is really longing to do is worship, to stand in awe of a God we don't understand and can't explain. I started thinking about what Penny was saying and what Ravi Zacharias says. I was riding my motorcycle down to Home Depot, wondering if Penny and Ravi would make good friends, when I decided I was being stupid, very wasteful and stupid. I knew we had an extension cord in the basement, and I knew I was really going to Home Depot to get some drill bits or a laser level or one of those tap lights, and that I wasn't going to get an extension cord but something else, something I would find when I got there, something that would call to me from its shelf. At the time, I didn't have very much money, and the money I had, I needed to learn to use wisely. Money does not belong to me, Rick once told me. Money is God's. He trusts us to dish it out fairly and with a strong degree of charity. I heard an interview with Bill Gates, and the interviewer asked him if he knew how rich he was, if he could really get his mind around it. He said he couldn't. The only way I can understand it, he said, is that there is nothing I can't buy. If I want something, I can have it. He said that Microsoft saved him because he was really more interested in what he was doing than how much money he had. Lots of rich people are not happy, he said. Sometimes I am glad I don't have very much money. I think money might own me if I had too much of it. I think I would buy things and not be satisfied with the things I have, so I would have to buy more. Jesus said it is harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. Rick says money should be your tool and that you should control it. It shouldn't control you. This means when I want a new extension cord and I already have one, I should use the one I have and give the rest of the money to people who were having very hard times in their lives. This means I probably didn't need to buy a timer for the lamp. Rick said I should be giving money to Imago Dei, our church. He said giving 10% would be a good place to start. I knew this already. It's called tithing, and somehow it's biblical. The Bible also tells the story of these beautiful people in the very first Christian churches who were giving all their money to the church, and the elders are dishing it back out to the community based on need. One of my good friends, Kurt Heidschmidt, gave me a lecture about tithing not very long ago. It was strange to get a lecture about tithing from Kurt because Kurt is not even a church sort of guy. He goes and all, but he hates it. Usually people who go to church but hate it aren't going around giving lectures about tithing, but Kurt gave me a pretty good talking to. Kurt works at a cabinet shop and cusses all the time and tells dirty jokes. But he tithes, sort of. He used to keep a huge jar on his dresser that was full of money, and when he deposited his paychecks, he would pull out 10% from the bank. Cold, hard cash. He would take the money home and put it in that jar. The thing must have had a couple $1,000s in it. I was over one night watching South Park, and Kurt was griping because the cabinet shop didn't pay him enough so that he could get the motorcycle he wanted. Well, I told him, you must have thousands of dollars in that stinking jar, Kurt. Use that. This was before I knew it was his tithing money. Can't. Why? Can't. Why? Isn't mine, Miller. Kurt leaned back in his recliner and looked at me over the top of his beer can. Isn't yours? I asked. Who in the world is storing their savings on your dresser? I pointed toward his bedroom. Well, he smiled, sort of embarrassed. It's God's. God's? I shouted. Yeah, that's my tithe, he shouted back. I was a little shocked, to be honest. Like I said before, he didn't seem like the tithing type. I don't think he even went to church 9 out of 10 Sundays, and when he did, he just grumbled about it. Well, why don't you take it down to the church and give it to them? I asked. I haven't been to church in a while, that's why. Kurt, I told him, you are the most interesting person I know. Thank you, Don. You want a beer? Yes. Kurt went over to the fridge and opened a couple of Henrys. You tithe, Don? I just looked at him. I couldn't believe it. I was about to get a lecture on tithing from a guy who probably subscribed to Bikes and Babes magazine. Well, Kurt, I guess I don't. After I said this, Kurt shook his head in disappointment. I started feeling really guilty. It's a shame, Don. Kurt tilted back a bottle as he spoke, punctuating the sentence with a post-swig burp. You were missing out. I've been tithing since I was a kid. Wouldn't miss a payment to save my life. Am I dreaming this? I asked him. Dreaming what, Don? This conversation. When I said this, I was pointing back and forth between he and I. Don, let me tell you. You should be tithing. That is not your money. That is God's money. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, stealing from God and all. You write Christian books and everything, and you're not even giving God's money back to him. Well, you don't have to go making me feel all bad about it. You haven't exactly given your money to God either. It's right there on your dresser. Kurt leaned over the big arm of his recliner and with a Jack Nicholson grin on his face said, Oh, you don't worry about that, big boy. That's God's money, and he's gonna get it. I've never stolen a dime from God, and I'm never gonna start. I honestly couldn't believe this was happening to me. I go over to Kurt's house to watch South Park, and I get a guilt trip from a fundamentalist. Kurt went down about 2 weeks later and turned all his money into a church secretary. More than $3,000. I started feeling so guilty I couldn't sleep. I met with Rick after that and confessed I was not giving any money to Imago Dei. Rick had come over to the house and we were lying about how much we could bench press, and then I just blurted it out, I'm not giving any money to the church, Rick, not a dime. Okay, he said. Interesting way to change the conversation. Why? He asked. Why aren't you giving any money to the church? Because I don't have any money. Everything goes to rent and groceries. That sounds like a tough situation, he said, very compassionately. So am I exempt? I asked. Nope, he said. We want your cash. How much? I asked. How much do you make? I don't know. About $1,000 a month, maybe? Then we want 100. And you should also know how much you make. Part of the benefit of giving a portion of your money is it makes you think about where your money goes. God does not want us to be sloppy with our finances, Don. But I need money for rent. You also need to trust God. I know. I just think it would be easier to trust God if I had extra money to trust him with. That would not be faith, then, would it? No. Well, bud, I just want you to know I hate this part of the job because it sounds like I'm asking for your money. I don't care whether or not we have your money. Our needs are met. I want to tell you that you are missing out on so much, Don. So much what? The fruit of obedience, he said, looking very pastoral. When we do what God wants us to do, we are blessed. We are spiritually healthy. God wants us to give a portion of our money to his work on earth. By setting aside money from every check, you are trusting God to provide. He wants you to get over that fear of trusting him. It is a scary place, but that is where you have to go as a follower of Christ. There are times when my wife and I don't have enough money to cover bills, but we know the first bill, the first payment we make is to the church. That is most important. If the other bills get neglected, then we need to watch how we are spending money. And there are times when we have found ourselves in that situation. But it works out. We are getting good at trusting God, and we are getting good at managing money. The next week, I emptied my checking account, which had about $8 in it, and I gave it to the church. Another check came a few days later, and I gave 10% of that to the church. Then I got another writing gig with a magazine in Atlanta, and as I deposited that check into my account, I wrote a check to the church. One after another, I started getting called to speak at retreats and conferences that usually pay pretty well, and each time I would write a check to the church. Since then, since that conversation with Rick, I have given at least 10% of every dollar I make, just like Kurt. And I have never not had rent. For more than a year, my checking account had hovered or dipped just over or just under zero, and suddenly, I had money to spare. I decided I would open a savings account in case someday I would get married and have a family, and with each bit of money that came in, I would give 10% to the church and 10% to the savings account. I was actually budgeting money. I had never done that before. But that is not the best part. The best part is what tithing has done for my relationship with God. Before, I felt like I was always going to God with my fingers crossed, the way a child feels around his father when he knows he has told terrible lies. God knew where I was. He didn't love me any different when I was holding out on him. It's just that I didn't feel clean around him. And you know how that can affect things. I also learned that I needed to give to the poor. My church gives money to the poor, but it was also important for me to give directly to the poor. I would go downtown sometimes and buy a homeless person lunch. I hated it at first because I always stumbled across the guys with terrible table manners. But after a while, I began to like their drunken ramblings. Even though they weren't making any sense, they thought they were. And that has to count for something. We don't need as much money as we have. Hardly any of us need as much money as we have. It's true what they say about the best things in life being free. For a little while, a long time ago, I was a minimalist. I wasn't a minimalist on purpose, it's just that my friend Paul and I had been traveling around the country living in a van, like I mentioned earlier. We eventually ran out of money, so we sold the van and lived in the woods. We lived in the Cascade Mountains for a month. We walked through the woods into a resort every day where I scrubbed toilets in condos and Paul worked as a lifeguard. I ate the food people would leave in the refrigerator after they had checked out. Mostly perishables. Ice cream, fruit, cheese. I only tell you this because when we were living in the woods, we didn't worry about anything, especially about money. After about a week, I stopped wondering if food was going to show. I learned that people throw tons of food away, and there will always be plenty. I didn't think about rent because I didn't pay rent. The forest is free, it turns out. Great property all over. There I was, living in one of the most beautiful territories in all of America, eating free food and sleeping under the stars. It did not take long for that nagging feeling of fear, the false feeling of security that money gives us, to subside. I remember a particular midnight, 3 weeks into our stay, walking into a meadow surrounded by thick aspens, and above me all that glorious heaven glowing, and I felt like I was a part of it, what with the trees clapping hands and me feeling like I was floating there beneath the endlessness. I looked up so long I felt like I was in space. Light. No money and no anxiety. It is possible to feel that way again. It is possible not to let possessions own me, to rest happily in the security that God, not money, can give. I have been feeling that a little lately. Rick asked me how I was doing with the money thing, with the tithe thing, and I told him I was on the up and up. He asked me how I was feeling about all of that, and I told him I was feeling good, free, light. He told me not to get a big head about it. Chapter 17. Worship. The Mystical Wonder. I read a book a long time ago about Mother Teresa. Somebody in the book asked her how she summoned the strength to love so many people. She said she loved people because they are Jesus. Each one of them is Jesus, and this is true because it says so in the Bible. and it is also true that this idea contradicts the facts of reality. Everybody can't be Jesus. There are many ideas within Christian spirituality that contradict the facts of reality as I understand them. A statement like this offends some Christians because they believe if aspects of their faith do not obey the facts of reality, they are not true. But I think there are all sorts of things our hearts believe that don't make any sense to our heads. Love, for instance. We believe in love. Beauty. Jesus as God. It comforts me to think that if we are created beings, the thing that created us would have to be greater than us, so much greater, in fact, that we would not be able to understand it. It would have to be greater than the facts of our reality, and so it would seem to us, looking out from within our reality, that it would contradict reason. But reason itself would suggest it would have to be greater than reality, or it would not be reasonable. When we worship God, we worship a being our life experience does not give us the tools with which to understand. If we could, God would not inspire awe. Eternity, for example, is not something the human mind can understand. We may be able to wrap our heads around living forever, and we can do this only because none of us has experienced death, but can we understand what it means to have never been born? I only say this to illustrate that we, as Christians, believe things we cannot explain. And so does everybody else. I have a friend who is a seminary student who criticizes certain Christian writers for embracing what he calls mysticism. I asked him if his statement meant that he was not a mystic. "Of course not," he told me. I asked him if he believed in the Trinity. He said he did. I asked him if he believed that the Trinity represented three separate persons who were also one. He said he did. I asked him if that would be considered a mystical idea. He just stood there thinking. You cannot be a Christian without being a mystic. I was talking to a homeless man at a laundromat recently, and he said that when we reduce Christian spirituality to math, we defile the holy. I thought that was very beautiful and comforting, because I have never been good at math. Many of our attempts to understand Christian faith have only cheapened it. I can no more understand the totality of God than the pancake I made for breakfast understands the complexity of me. The little we do understand, that grain of sand our minds are capable of grasping, those ideas such as God is good, God feels, God loves, God knows all, are enough to keep our hearts dwelling on His majesty and otherness forever. Here is one of the coolest things I ever did. This past summer I made a point to catch sunsets. I would ride my motorcycle up Mount Tabor and sit on the steps of the reservoir to watch the sun put fire in the clouds that are always hanging over Portland. I never really wanted to make the trip. I would want to watch television or make a sandwich, but I made myself go. And once I got up there, I always loved it. It always meant something to me to see beauty right there over my city. My first sunset this year was the most spectacular. Forest fires in Washington State blew a light, nearly unnoticeable haze through Portland, and the clouds were just low enough to catch the full reflection of red and yellow. I thought to myself, this is something that happens all the time. From the ridge on Tabor where I planted myself, I could see the entire skyline, the home of more than 1 million people. On most nights, there were no more than 2 or 3 people there with me. All that beauty happens right above the heads of more than 1 million people who never notice it. Here is what I've started thinking. All the wonder of God happens right above our arithmetic and formula. The more I climb outside my pat answers, the more invigorating the view, the more my heart enters into worship. I love how the Gospels start, with John the Baptist eating bugs and baptizing people. The religious people started getting baptized because it had become popular, and John yells at them and calls them snakes. He says the water won't do anything for them. It will only get their snake skins wet. But if they meant it, if they had faith that Jesus was coming and was real, then Jesus would ignite the kingdom life within them. I love that because for so long religion was my false gospel. But there was no magic in it, no wonder, no awe, no kingdom life burning in my chest. And when I get tempted by that same stupid Christian religion, I go back to the beginning of the Gospels and am comforted that there is something more than the emptiness of ritual. God will ignite the kingdom life within me, the Bible says. That's mysticism. It isn't a formula that I am figuring out. It is something God does. One night I watched the sunset till the stars faded in, and while looking up, my mind, or my heart, I do not know which, realized how endless it all was. I laid myself down on some grass and reached my hand directly out toward where? I don't know. There is no up and down. There has never been an up and down. Things like up and down were invented so as not to scare children, so as to reduce mystery to math. The truth is, we do not know there is an end to material existence. It may go on forever, which is something the mind cannot understand. My friend Jason and I went on a trip to Joshua Tree in Death Valley, and he had a map folded across his lap nearly the entire trip. Even when I was driving, he had the map out, following along with his finger the trajectory of the car, noting how close we were to certain towns, certain lakes. Jason liked to know where we were on the map, and so did I, as a matter of fact. But I was afraid to tell Jason about the universe, how scientists haven't found the edge of it, of how nobody knows exactly where we are on the map. I think we have two choices in the face of such big beauty: terror or awe. And this is precisely why we attempt to chart God, because we want to be able to predict him, to dissect him, to carry him around in our dog and pony show. We are too proud to feel awe and too fearful to feel terror. We reduce him to math so we don't have to fear him, and yet the Bible tells us fear is the appropriate response, that it is the beginning of wisdom. Does this mean God is going to hurt us? No. But I stood on the edge of the Grand Canyon once, behind a railing, and though I was never going to fall off the edge, I feared the thought of it. It is that big of a place, that wonderful of a landscape. I like that scene in the movie Dead Poets Society in which Mr. Keating, an English instructor at an elite preparatory school, asks his students to rip out the Introduction to Poetry essay from their literature textbooks. The essayist had instructed students in a method of grading poems on a sliding scale, complete with the use of a grid, thus reducing art for the heart into arithmetic for the head. The students looked around at each other in confusion as their teacher dismissed the essay as rubbish and ordered them to rip these pages from their books. And at their teacher's loud prodding, the students began to rip. Dr. Keating paced the aisle with a trash can and reminded the students that poetry is not algebra, not songs on American Bandstand that can be rated on a scale from 1 to 10, but rather they are pieces of art that plunge the depths of the heart to stir vigor in men and woo women. Too much of our time is spent trying to chart God on a grid, and too little is spent allowing our hearts to feel awe. By reducing Christian spirituality to formula, we deprive our hearts of wonder. When I think about the complexity of the Trinity, the three-in-one God, my mind cannot understand, but my heart feels wonder in abundant satisfaction. It is as though my heart, in the midst of its euphoria, is saying to my mind, "There are things you cannot understand, and you must learn to live with this." Not only must you learn to live with this, You must learn to enjoy this. I want to tell you something about me that you may see as weakness. I need wonder. I know that death is coming. I smell it in the wind, read it in the paper, watch it on television, and see it on the faces of the old. I need wonder to explain what is going to happen to me, what is going to happen to us when this thing is done, when our shift is over and our kids' kids are still on the earth listening to their crazy rap music. I need something mysterious to happen after I die. I need to be somewhere else after I die, somewhere with God, somewhere that wouldn't make any sense if it were explained to me right now. At the end of the day, when I am lying in bed and I know the chances of any of our theology being exactly right are 1,000,000 to 1, I need to know that God has things figured out, that if my math is wrong, we are still going to be okay. And wonder is that feeling we get when we let go of our silly answers, our mapped-out rules that we want God to follow. I don't think there is any better worship than wonder. Chapter 18. Love. How to really love other people. When my friend Paul and I lived in the woods, we lived with hippies. Well, sort of hippies. They certainly smoked a lot of pot. They drank a lot of beer. And man, did they love each other. Sometimes too much, perhaps. Too physically, you know. But nonetheless, they loved. They accepted and cherished everybody, even the ones who judged them because they were hippies. It was odd living with the hippies at first, but I enjoyed it after a while. They were not the traveling hippies, the live-off-the-land-and-other-people hippies. They were formally educated, most of them from New York, studying at NYU, getting their master's in literature, headed off to law school, that sort of thing. They knew all about Rostand, all about Hopkins and Poe and Sylvia Plath. They knew the Americans and the Brits and the fashionable African writers, the Cubans and South Americans. They were books themselves. All of them were books, and what was so wonderful is that to them, I was a book too. We would sit around and talk about literature and each other, and I couldn't tell the difference between the books they were talking about and their lives. They were just that cool. I liked them very much because they were interested in me. When I was with the hippies, I did not feel judged. I felt loved. To them, I was an endless well of stories and perspectives and grand literary views. It felt so wonderful to be in their presence, like I was special. I have never experienced a group of people who loved each other more than my hippies in the woods. All of them are tucked so neatly into my memory now, and I recall our evenings at camp or in the meadow or in the caves in my mind like a favorite film. I pull them out when I need to be reminded about goodness, about purity and kindness. The resort we were working at was Black Butte Ranch in Central Oregon, and we were living about a mile off a ridge beyond the cattle fence, down in a gully where stood stately pines and remarkable aspen. There were also a family of deer and a porcupine. The boys from New York worked at Honker's Cafe, named for the ducks. And Paul and I would merely have to sit ourselves on the deck off the lake, and within minutes we would have a burger or a shake or a slice of pie, always delivered with a smile, always for free. They were stealing from the rich to feed the poor. We were eating food from the wealthy table of the white man. This is how I thought about it, even though I was white. After Honkers closed, we would fill the cafe and play the jukebox, the guys always choosing Springsteen and talking about life in New York, about life in the city. But more than they talked, they listened. So much of what I know about getting along with people I learned from the hippies. They were magical in community. People were drawn to them. They asked me what I loved, what I hated, how I felt about this and that, what sort of music made me angry, what sort of music made me sad. They asked me what I daydreamed about, what I wrote about, where my favorite places in the world were, They asked me about high school and college and my travels around America. They loved me like a good novel, like an art film. And this is how I felt when I was with them, like a person John Irving would write. I did not feel fat or stupid or sloppily dressed. I did not feel like I did not know the Bible well enough, and I was never conscious what my hands were doing or whether or not I sounded immature when I talked. I had always been so conscious of those things, but living with the hippies, I forgot about myself. And when I lost this self-consciousness, I gained so much more. I gained an interest in people outside my own skin. They were greater than movies to me, greater than television. The spirit of the hippies was contagious. I couldn't hear enough about Eddie's ballerina girlfriend or Owen's epic poems. I would ask them to repeat stories because to me, they were like great scenes in favorite movies. I cannot tell you how quickly these people, these pot-smoking hippies, disarmed me. Because I grew up in the safe cocoon of big Christianity, I came to believe that anything outside the church was filled with darkness and unlove. I remember one Sunday evening, sitting in the pew as a child listening to the pastor read from articles in the newspaper. He took an entire hour to flip through the paper reading about all the gory murders and rapes and burglaries, and after each article he would sigh and say, "Friends, it is a bad, bad world out there, and things are only getting worse." Never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined there were, outside the church, people so purely lovely as the ones I met in the woods. And yet, my hippie friends were not at all close to believing that Christ was the Son of God. This did not confuse me so much as it surprised me. Until this point, the majority of my friends had been Christians. In fact, nearly all of them had been Christians. I was amazed to find, outside the church, genuine affection being shared, affection that seemed, well, authentic in comparison to the sort of love I had known within the church. I was even more amazed when I realized I preferred, in fact, the company of the hippies to the company of Christians. It isn't that I didn't love my Christian friends or that they didn't love me. It was just that there was something different about my hippie friends. Something, I don't know, more real, more true. I realize that is a provocative statement, but I only felt I could be myself around them, and I could not be myself with my Christian friends. My Christian communities had always had little unwritten social ethics like don't cuss and don't support Democrats and don't ask tough questions about the Bible. I stayed in the woods only a month. I wanted to stay longer. But I had secured a job in Colorado at a Christian camp and needed to honor that agreement. Though I had spent only a month with the hippies, it seemed a lifetime. I had learned more about people, about community and happiness and contentment by living in the woods than I had in a lifetime of studying these ideas philosophically. I had discovered life outside the church, and I liked it. As I said, I preferred it. I said my sad goodbyes and boarded a bus bound for Colorado. Before getting off the Greyhound bus, I threw away my pack of cigarettes. I knew I would not be able to smoke while working at camp. The guy who picked me up from the bus station could smell the smoke on my clothes, so he sat quietly and asked few questions. Though Paul and I had been in the woods for only a month, we had been traveling around America for several months, and so the first thing I noticed when I got to camp was that these were clean people. They ironed their clothes and that sort of thing. They had clean-shaven faces and spoke through smiles. I liked them. They all looked so new to me, so much like they belonged in storefront windows, like fine china dolls or models for Banana Republic. There was a buzz about me almost immediately. I didn't want there to be, but I had been traveling for so long I'd forgotten some basic things like sleeping indoors and eating with utensils. Some of the bolder staff members approached me to try to talk. I think they thought I was sort of stupid because they spoke very slowly and made wide motions with their hands as they spoke. "I'm Jane. My name, Jane. What your name?" The camp director, a very conservative man, sent word to me through a servant that I was to